Welcome to Thinking Out Loud, the podcast that puts you inside conversations with the most deeply passionate, crazy smart, wildly creative, openly collaborative, quietly wise, fabulously funny, intensely dedicated, and yes, the most thoughtful people in our industry. So sit back and stay tuned. They may just change the way you think.
Hello. On today's podcast, I'm speaking with Barry Jossen, Executive Vice President at A&E Studios. That's the in-house production arm of A&E Networks, which is a global media company. And Barry is an award-winning producer and television and film executive. Welcome, Barry.
Thank you.
I think that we should start by talking a bit about A&E Studios. It's probably not the part of the business that folks are most familiar with. When was it launched? What projects are you working on, and what can we look forward to?
So I think it's worth noting that A&E Networks has a lengthy history of scripted programming across the various networks, you know, the primary networks being A&E Lifetime and History. As I mentioned, they have a very lengthy history with scripted series specifically and a lot of success with them. Over the years, they had shows like Army Wives, Devious Maids, Bates Motel. I was trying to remember some of the other titles as I look across the networks. Vikings. What occurred to them with, this is an interesting story also as it relates to changes that have gone on in the industry and issues that we're dealing with today. But what occurred to them was that they had this lengthy history with scripted and a very successful history, but they never owned a single show. So going back about 5 years ago, they basically had a couple of realizations and made a decision. The most significant realization was, or conclusion was, that they wanted to continue to have scripted series programming on their networks. But in order to make it most viable for them going forward, they had to have more ownership. And in order to have ownership, you have to, the way the television process works, you have to create the shows, develop them, produce them, deficit finance, and eventually distribute. At the time, there was no internal resource to manage the issues of own programming, own scripted, so they recruited me to come to A&E to build and manage a studio for them. So the studio, I guess we'll say day one was when I arrived, so it's been 4.5 years. It's been a very, very busy, productive 4.5 years. Among the shows that we produced, or the series that we produced, are Unreal, for Lifetime, which has had over its run enormous critical acclaim, multiple awards, including a Peabody. For History, we produced the Navy SEAL Series 6. We've just now started production on the second season of Nightfall for History. We've completed Project Blue Book for History, and other notable titles include the reimagining of Roots, which we produced as an 8-hour miniseries for History, again, to great critical acclaim and award acknowledgement.
That's a wide variety of content and topics, very different audiences. What's your day like, bouncing around between so many different network brands, programming areas?
So it's important to note, in building a studio, we built a very kind of the very modern configuration of a studio. It has 9 basic departments. I don't have to list them off for you, but you know, there is a creative team, and the creative team manages both development and current programming. So development is origination of ideas, working with writers, producers, etc., developing scripts, and then current programming is overseeing, once a series or production has been ordered, overseeing that process from a creative point of view. So I only bring this up because, you know, the creative team, their full-time focus is on issues of creativity, so they have the ability. It's a very tightly run operation. They have their time in which they focus on what they're doing for Lifetime, what they're doing for History, and also, as the studio grows, what we're doing for third-party services. We're very actively developing and producing now outside of the A&E networks. When you ask what my day is like, I can give you as much or as little detail. We have regular meetings once every 2 weeks with the scripted programmers from the various A&E networks. So we're only talking about Lifetime scripted, or we're only talking about History scripted.
Are the creative teams structured to focus by network?
No, they are. No, that studio, they cover everything. But, you know, okay, we do have our individual meetings. So that it gives us the opportunity to have the hyper-focus to really be conscious of what are the creative attributes that might work for best for Lifetime, what are the creative attributes that work best for History, and how, as we are developing and nurturing our projects, that we're, you know, we're hyper-targeting them so that we could ultimately have a series that has a lot of appeal for their viewers. The rest of my day is involved in a lot of other fun activities, working with folks in production, post-production, music, business affairs, legal, etc., you know, managing the operational elements of the studio.
So let's talk a little bit about the creative attributes
Please.
That really resonate with today's viewers. Because viewers are consuming media and entertainment so differently. And in fact, why don't we back up a little bit, because your background is so deep. Looking back on the history of television leading up to where we are now, how has the viewer experience evolved? What have you seen as this evolution has continued?
Oh, I am, as some of the folks in this room know, I am very focused on, I'm a student of the industry. I read everything I can get my hands on, whether it's available online, in print, and I actually even read books, always on a device. I never actually have paper in my hand.
I'm right there with you.
And there's a lot of fascinating, there's a lot of interesting stories going on. But I think as you look at the viewer experience and you think about it from my point of view, I will tell you the specific answer, and I want to tell you an anecdote of something that occurred yesterday on the production of Project Blue Book that
Great.
I think is very telling an answer to this. What's going on in the viewer experience, simply put, is the experience has gotten so easy. You push a button, you could push one button and watch your TV show. It couldn't be easier than that, and that's exactly, that's the viewer experience through which I feel we now, any of us who are going to be successful in our industry must really be focused on. That's anyone can push a button and watch their show. And what's interesting in terms of some of the either services that exist or emerging and devices that exist or emerging is that more and more what we're going to learn is we're each our own network and we're programming for ourselves and it will all be available in some app or in some environment within our devices. And what we'll see as we watch is we could start the whole concept of TV everywhere, which is so fascinating. You could watch whatever you want, wherever you are, whenever you want, and on whatever device is most convenient at that time. And what we're going to experience, more and more people are experiencing already, it will become more ubiquitous, is this notion that maybe in the morning you could push the button and start watching your show on your laptop and not complete it. It's an episode, not complete it. And now you're commuting, you're waiting for a train, bus, boat, whatever, however you get to and from your home, your work, your school, etc. And open your device and continue watching that episode, that TV show, on exactly the frame it was on when you stopped watching on another device. Later on, you might be at home and want to watch it on a big screen. You can push the button again, continue watching. So this is the consumer experience. It's very interesting how it applies to the work that we do. Yesterday afternoon, I spent most of the afternoon on a sound mixing stage for a new project we're producing for History called Project Blue Book. We just completed a panel about it. Blue Book, as you know, is a drama that is about the based on real, true U.S. government investigations into the possible existence of UFOs, set into the 1950s and 60s. So the creative process goes on for a long, long time, and it has many different facets. So yesterday afternoon, we were doing our final sound mix for the first episode, and the final sound mix is an aggregation of all of the dialogue, sound effects, music, and in some cases, even with music or sound effect, each individual instrument of music or each individual sound is on its own channel, so you can program where exactly how it's in sync with picture, its level, you know, the level of the sound relative to other elements of the mix and everything else, so that it all aggregates all together into, you know, one complete mix, and that's the viewer experience. They get to hear the show as we prepared it for them, right? So the way these sound mixing studios are set up in Hollywood is they're big, giant recording studios with huge screens and big speakers that were created, that were built to recreate the theatrical experience. How people might watch a show or a movie in a theater, or, this is a very important point as it relates to how TV evolved, in a home theater environment, okay? And when you play it back that way, it's big and it's loud and all the rest. But what's happened in the sound mixing experience to try and recreate I got to figure out how to make this shorter. The viewing experience is they now have little speakers in the room.
Right.
And sometimes the playback happens and you just listen to it all in little speakers. So I was there. I go to the stage. They've been working and working and mixing. We discuss the rules of the playback. We're going to watch the whole pilot at one, in one run. And we're not, you know, we're all going to write. I'm specific. Literally, there are 15 people in the room who want to know what I think. So I'm writing notes, and as I'm listening, I'm getting more and more agitated because the playback is in the big speakers. And I was very sensitive to, while I thought the music we had was very beautiful, I was convinced when it went into the smaller speakers, you would feel music, you would be conscious that there was music in the soundtrack, but you would never be able to hum a tune or even identify the melody. Because as you reduce to a smaller and smaller playback, the sound reduces and certain things get consumed, music gets consumed on the dialogue. When we were playing it back, I mean, after the playback, and I was explaining this concern that I had, that they mixed to the theater experience, and then they played back that way, that the mix was not properly balanced, and that when it was played through the smaller speakers, all this great sound would just disappear. And the way I articulated how important that was, because I'm now conscious that people more and more are watching generally through smaller devices, handheld and tablets and laptops, and frequently or mostly hearing the sound through these little teeny tiny little speakers. Occasionally people put on headphones. And I said, 10 years ago we were mixing to home theater because that was state of the art of TV, but that's not state of the art of TV anymore. Now it's this other thing, you know, and I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a moment. And I was like, I want to play back Act One right now, and I want it to be through the small speakers. And first they were arguing with me, and then I said, let's just do this. Let's just stop. Let's just listen through Act One. And I can tell you, like, when the Act One was over, there were a lot of faces that were very red and a lot of sheepish expressions, because sure enough, while the dialogue came through for the most part, all of the other wonderful sound that they had created was barely there, barely perceptible. So what's interesting also about the viewer experience is that it's becoming more and more of what I call a customized experience, mm-hmm. right? It's you get to watch your show and I get to watch my show. I believe what's playing out is there's less and less co-viewing in homes, with the possible exception of the Neil McDonough family. They watch together and then they talk about it. I don't get to have that experience with my family. But I feel like more and more people are watching on, you know, they're watching their own show, what they want, when they want, what device is available. And so I feel like now as we're thinking about our creative process and how we're making all these, we're fine-tuning or optimizing it for viewing, that we need to think about now how things have changed. And I will explain what that is, because I feel like if you asked me earlier about the history of television, my view is there was a 50-year run where quality was defined as bigger picture and better sound, which culminated between 2008 and 2012 in this home theater concept. But I don't think the quality is defined anymore at all by the quality of the picture and the quality of the sound. I think quality is now defined, you know, and people can give it, you know, it's what I'm going to say is going to sound odd because different people and different generations and different, you know, people have different kinds of expectations. So I really think quality in television right now is defined as convenience and ubiquity. The younger people are watching TV and experiencing it in a very different way than maybe what we did. What makes them feel good and comfortable and wanting to engage and feeling that when they push the button, they're going to get what they want is by the convenience that we provide for them in finding it and knowing that it's there and finding it, and then the ubiquity that when they push the button, no matter where they are, what they're doing, or when they're doing it, the show is there for them.
You're probably listening to this podcast because you're a smart, busy executive who wants to keep up with the latest news and trends efficiently. And you're probably also a CTAM Smart Brief subscriber. Did you say no? Then you're missing out on the finest industry news briefing, deftly delivered daily to your inbox. Like I said, it's smart, it's brief, it's always free, and read by thousands of leaders like you. Sign up today at smartbrief.com/CTAM.
So talk a little bit about the visual impact of that, because now you've got people watching on vertical screens and you've got people watching with you know, distractions around them. So does the story arc need to be different? Is the narrative changing because people's attention spans are changing and their consumption habits are changing? And how does that impact the...
So you asked several ways. Hold that thought, because you asked so many questions and there are very multiple tracks. On the picture, here's what is clear. We call it image capture, right? And where now everything is being captured digitally. It's all going on a gigantic chip, whatever a chip is. I don't exactly know what it is, but like it looks really good when you look at it in playback. And it's all going to file, which is important because it's all random access. Like the same way we could push a button on a set and watch everything that we shot. Interestingly, they still say things like roll camera on set. But there's no rolling involved. There's no film. There's no tape. It's a file. Like, literally, I could just as easily say, push the button. And maybe someday they'll go to that. So what's important, though, is the image quality, the lenses, the quality of the glass that we have, and the quality of these chips that capture everything that goes through that lens is so fantastic. It's so huge. And megapixels. There's all kinds of cool things that we could talk about, but we're not going to. The image capture is amazing, so the quality is at a higher level than it's ever been and is so pristine, and because it exists in this digital space and all of the various playback devices along the way are all digital and are all optimized for it, whether you're watching on whatever your small device is, your tablet, your laptop, or a beautiful flat-screen TV in your home, it will look good, right? So we've managed that, and that's why I feel like while we continue to aspire to creative beauty and achievement in everything we do, and I think that the film craftsmen all over the world are so fantastic at this ambition, and they achieve it in a great way, the way that we all get to experience it pretty much gives us what they intended. It's not like film and all the vagaries and theaters and projector lights and brightness of exit signs and all these things that people used to obsess about. No one it's not a problem anymore. So we're certainly able to deliver a really beautiful picture, no matter how people are being able to see it. We are still industrially presenting our shows and our films in a theatrical format, which is whatever, there's an aspect ratio. It's approximately 16 by 9. However, you bring up a very interesting issue that now, you know, because so in other words, here's another way of saying it. The way we are accustomed to experiencing film, it's landscape view. It's wider than it is tall. That's what we're used to experiencing, right? And that's why many people, when they watch their shows, they turn their device to the side if they're watching on a device. However, you brought up an interesting point, and now there are these issues where there are a couple of social networks that want square. They literally want square, and that's how they want all their materials submitted, because they want people to hold their devices upright. Just last week, we were having a conversation. It was specific to the marketing of Blue Book, if we should prepare some of our trailers in this square format, because it might just appeal to that audience. And they, again, all the theories of imaging and how it affects us, and the unconscious thought that we have that either brings us in or pushes us away. And so there is a thought about like, well, wait, you know, so here's an example of that. So you probably would be more conscious if you see on commercials than, you know, in the programs. Some shows which were, or movies, TV shows, et cetera, which weren't shot in the 16 by 9 format, often, particularly, this is most true with commercials, will play on TV with a black band across the top and the bottom. They call that cropping, right? So the conversation was, oh, should we try and maybe produce promos where we crop the sides? Again, people are used to seeing, experiencing cropping on their TV. They're not turned off by it anymore because it's sort of ubiquitous. But maybe we should screw around with the how we're cropping and when we're cropping it. And that would be to apply to this, you know, that people are oriented now to that as a visual presentation, which they like, and it evokes some feeling in them. So there's that, and probably way more than you asked. You also asked, do we need to change storytelling? No, we don't. Maybe there's evolving of storytelling that's going on, and generally this stuff is happening, and we talk about what's happening in the future and all the rest, and we're not even paying attention to what's going on right now. I will generalize. What we know factually, and what we see, someone said to me, simple is best. When you're faced with certain decisions, simplest is best. It works most often. So here's the example of that for television. what is consistently working the best on television for TV shows are shows that are 30 minutes in length, or approximately, and 60 minutes in length. People are very used to watching them. They're very comfortable. They're very comfortable allocating their time. And writers and creators are very comfortable writing and creating to those time frames. It works. It works really well. And we should continue to nurture that. However, what we are seeing, and this is a generational shift, is more and more interest in short-form programming. YouTube is booming. However, the majority of the short-form programming that's booming on YouTube are how-tos, DIYs, sketch comedy, clips, cutdowns of other things. The few instances I see where there's really kind of like significant investment and or success, even in the YouTube space, like with YouTube Red, are still shows that are 30 minutes and 60 minutes long. So I guess maybe, you know, I know it was just announced, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg has raised $1 billion for his company, and he really wants to do shorter form programming. You know, they'll figure out great stories that could be told, and that could either be told in less time or in chapters. But you'll see, even when they start doing it in chapters, it will be interesting to see that when you aggregate all the chapters together, do they fit into time lengths that we are already, that are most popular today?
When you were with ABC, you were early into this curve. You founded and launched ABC Signature.
Right, and even before that, I actually founded and launched something called Stage 9, which was the very, very first digital studio that existed at the Walt Disney Company.
Okay.
Years before Maker.
Talk a little bit about that. What did you see that had you move in that direction? And if I understand correctly, Signature was creating content for off-network and emerging platforms, and so I would imagine you were working in the space that you were just talking to us about.
So what was going on at that time in television was there were no streamers, right? Television at that time was very much the broadcast networks and the cable industry. We had at ABC Studios a very significant and successful practice or business in producing high quality, you know, well produced and somewhat expensive series for broadcast television. Within the norm that wanted shows that fit within a certain price range, we excelled. Certainly what we recognized is that we loved the cable television networks. We loved the cable television business. We also loved, frankly, and what we're identifying was there was the emergence of creative opportunity in cable that just didn't exist in broadcast for whatever combinations of reasons, branding and, you know, whatever the reasons were. They were all perfectly valid, but we recognized that there was a lot of opportunity for creative expression and, you know, that we didn't have, that wasn't completely available in broadcast. We also identified that the successful efforts in producing for cable and emerging networks, emerging services, et cetera, required much greater ingenuity in cost management. Simply put, if sometimes you just had less money to do and you needed to deliver the same, if not a lot more for it. So what we realized is we looked around the industry, we looked around other industries, et cetera, and even within our own organization, what we realized was if we needed to do a lot of things differently and a lot of things with ingenuity, maybe it was best to have a different organization to do it. People who were more solely focused on that, and frankly, more solely focused on starting again with the creative. We're looking for the projects that are going to the cable networks, that are going to emerging networks, that are going off the beaten path. We're looking to take, in the case of ABC Studios, your roster of talent and producers and everything else who have that passion project where there's no other place for it, and we'll try and find a home or a way of getting it made. And around that, we needed to build a team that all had the same mindset. They were going to produce in different parts of the world. They were going to implement different types of production methodology, staff size, cost management. And finally, again, it's, you know, we were talking about the viewer experience earlier. So now it's the talent experience. It needed to look different. So Signature was put in a different building, in a different set of offices. So as soon as people showed up, it was a different experience. You know, the talent, I should say, people showed up. So with the as the talent arrived, so it's now their experience, it felt different from the very moment they engaged. It wasn't like walking into the office building called ABC with the floors and floors of people who were, you know, doing all their broadcast network shows. And, oh, by the way, those same people are going to, like, redirect their thinking, their brain, the way they do their work, and do something very different in this one for this one project than they do for the other nine things they work on. So we created an environmental difference to support the enterprise.
Talent. You mentioned talent. How important is big name talent to driving viewership these days? And with the proliferation of content, that's, you know, it's spreading out, right? That's, that gets to be a bigger challenge.
I have very mixed feelings on this subject, okay? The purely creative side for me is I just want to find the best actors, writers, directors, producers, cinematographers, costume designers, production designers, etc. I can for every project I make. I just want to find the best. And to me, the best is defined by a combination of their, you know, their knowledge, skill, experience, their achievement, and frankly, in some cases, their passion for that project. There is nothing better, frankly, with the constant nerve-wracking decisions they have to make, to have someone who wins the job with their passion. However, there are a lot of TV shows being made, right? So here's what, to me, now becomes a necessity. What is our job? What is a new challenge in our job? And that challenge is we need to make sure that viewers need to know two really essential things, that it exists and how to find it. So maybe along the way, as we build up our marketing assets, our marketing tools, I mean, Walt Disney had a whole theory about this. I'm not going to even bother with that, but we need to get their attention, frankly, right? So a lot of people, it's literally, Kevin Costner, I like him. What's that? Oh, it's called Yellowstone and it's on that channel. Oh, I'm going to check that out. And so, yeah, having talent with a lot of popular notoriety is very helpful. It's very helpful. It's not like a cure-all. There are certainly examples of TV shows that have premiered that had big stars that didn't necessarily get viewers, but it absolutely helps to get sampling, you know, which was what they would call it, you know, for the first few episodes. I think it's worth noting also, it's interesting, because I was having this conversation with somebody about what makes a movie nowadays and what makes a TV show a TV show. And I realized it's so confusing. I'm a member of the Motion Picture Academy. I was having actually this discussion with another Academy member. And the discussion was, when the screeners, do you get screeners? Well, of course I get the screeners. I have like the world's greatest collection, the person said. I've saved every screener I've ever gotten. So do you vote? By the way, there are a lot of rules that the Academy encourages us to follow, and I'm very serious about doing it. So if you haven't seen a representative number of titles, you should not vote or cast a vote in a category. So I said, do you see all the films? I watch as much as possible. How often do you go to the theater, I asked. I see about 30% of them in the theater. 30%, so that means you're experiencing, I said, 70% of the movies as TV shows. So it's very interesting also, I only bring this up because you asked about talent, because what we're seeing is, is Tom Cruise literally the only movie star at this point who has not done television? And if that's true, like what's the distinction? We know Meryl Streep has, and you know, Julia Roberts has a series that's going to be premiering soon. Drew Barrymore has done several. By the way, pretty much as I go through that list of names, all of the titles in which they've appeared and have been successful, you know, it's made a difference for them to be in the cast.
Hope you found this Thinking Out Loud conversation interesting and perhaps even thought-provoking. There are more on the way. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review.